The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Welcome back to Soccer Supernova, a State of Mind's dedicated football chat show with me, Amy Canavan. Today, I am beyond delighted to be joined by the ex-Charlton, Luton, Aston Villa, Pisa, Celtic and Chelsea defender, Paul Elliott. Paul, it's an absolute honour. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
Oh, hi, Amy. Listen, I'm always honoured and delighted to be invited to talk football, but more importantly, with a club of the magnitude and stature and affection for Celtic. So I'm good. I'm delighted to be here. And was really keen, obviously, to engage with yourself when the kind invitation come to appear on your radio programme.
I am beyond honoured. Thank you so much. So you touched upon it there, obviously. We all know you are a former Celtic player. But let's go right back to the start. You grew up in Lewisham. How did you find that sort of environment growing up as a youngster?
Challenging. Lewisham, I mean, now you just wouldn't recognise the place. It's been so sort of gentrified. But back in the day, it was great. I loved it because there was a freedom about communities like Lewisham. And you had a lot of my family have sort of come from the West Indies. They come from the Windrush generation. And there was many of them that really sort of settled in that part of southeast London. So you had Lewisham, New Cross, Brixton, you know, all those sort of suburbs. So growing up there, you know, there was a sense of freedom. We didn't have a lot, you know, first generation immigrants. It was obviously, we had the struggles, but we had lots of love and we had lots of support as well. And I think that I went to school locally as well in Woolwich, an area called Woolwich in southeast London. And it's amazing, especially when you think about Lewisham over the next sort of 30, 40 years. If you look at the amount of the top English defenders or players that has come through Lewisham, you know, it's been amazing. You mean you had David Rowcastle, you've had Ian Wright, I mean, you've had Joe Gomez, who's a current England player, Tammy Abrahams. So there's been a real abundance of sort of talent that's come from the southeast of England, you know, to come through and forge their careers in football. So, listen, I love my growing up. I'm proud to be a Lewisham boy, as they say, a South London man. And I've got such great memories of growing up, playing football, you know, having fun. Because that's all you could do at the end of the day. You know, I was that sort of era, you know, two jerseys and you kick everything that moved. And, you know, the communities were different then, and it was so much safer then as well. So you could have your breakfast in the morning and then just go out, and I'd sort of come home for, you know, for a sandwich, you know, where we lived in a high-rise block in Lewisham. And then, you know, go back out and play football for the rest of the day, all imitating, pretending to be, you know, different players. So, you know, it was tough, it was challenging, but it was an immense fun, created sort of a lot of values. It gets you streetwise as well. You get an education through being on the street. And, you know, I have to say, you know, compared to sort of my life that my children sort of leave, completely different life, of course. But as I always say, you know, I wouldn't change my growing up for the world. Didn't have a lot, you know, but, you know, we had football, we had love. My parents were hardworking, come from a single parent family, hardworking people, and just taught us good values about respect and decency. And I was just so privileged to get my career through sort of South East London and get the opportunities, because I saw so many great players over the years who were extremely talented but couldn't cope with a lot of the social issues and obviously fell by the wayside, lost themselves. So a lot of regret for that. But obviously I was very focused. I had some very strong women in my mother and my grandmother, first generation, you know, immigrants. My grandmother was a small, stocky little woman, you know, and, you know, she was tough. She was uncompromising, but she gave us lots of love. And it's those real values, you know, that really I've taken with me in my life.
You touched upon it there, and it is all about opportunities. That is the fundamentals of any real success. So what were the opportunities like for you? What were the grassroots football? What were those steps?
Yeah, I mean, it was challenging. I was very lucky. I played for some local Sunday teams, and my brother Jeff, my eldest brother, he was an exceptional player, fabulous talent, and many people thought in our family if anybody was going to make the grade as an elite player, it would be him. Sadly, he went to West Ham when he was sort of 15, 16, got a couple of bad injuries and unfortunately didn't pursue a career. But, you know, playing up local was really good. I played for my local Sunday team and, you know, some of the pitches then, I mean, what they play on today, I mean, you know, it was it's like a cow field at times, to be quite honest with you. But, you know, playing locally, you know, playing for a local football team and also having, you know, I was kind of fairly fortunate because I got rejected by a number of clubs. You know, I had trials at Chelsea, had trials at Luton Town, had trials at West Ham. You know, all said I weren't good enough. So, you know, you lose that rejection, you lose that confidence. And you know, to be honest with you, I was playing on a common in South East London. And that's where my very first club, Charlton, it was a common not far from the football club. And a scout picked me up randomly, says, "Paul, we like you." I was like a little speedy right winger then. Didn't have, obviously, the kind of physicality. But I was fast, I was mobile, very nimble, playing as a right wing. And he says, "Listen, you know, we think you've got something. Why don't you come down?" And I was a bit, in honesty, I was disillusioned because nobody likes rejection. Nobody likes being told that you're good enough. And I remember, you know, they say adversity breeds character. I just kept plugging away. I just kept going and kept chasing my aspirations and my dreams. And then when I went to Charlton, you know, at sort of 15 years of age, you know, within about sort of 7 or 8 months, I was in the youth team, then straight in the reserves. And days, you know, as I was leaving school, which was very unusual, I got my debut in the first team against Crystal Palace. So it literally was like a, you know, I went in there as a boy, and then you become a man overnight when you're in that structured environment, because you had players who were sort of 27, 28, who were very mature, who looked very mature. And I was like a young 16, 17-year-old boy, you know. But obviously, you know, I was fairly big for my age and fairly strong. So whilst I was physically mature, obviously I wasn't emotionally mature. So that was the sort of difference to that integration into the football club was really, really good. And I learned so much.
Just before we move on to your career, and it's something that is a mainstay, and it's been, it's a recurring theme, and you're so open about it as well. And it's, it is the issue of racism. When you were growing up, you know, in South London, as you say, the opportunities, they were still there. But even at that young age, were you aware of societal racism? I understand that's quite a big question.
Yes, because ultimately, you know, my mother and father, first generation immigrants from Jamaica, they grew up in that. They come into this country, you know, and there were obvious challenges, you know. But, you know, it's quite interesting because, you know, my mum and dad, you know, particularly my dad, he had a lot of Irish and Scottish friends that they used to go to the pub with and have a drink, because basically, you know, different colours, but same principles, different cultures, isn't it? Because obviously, you know, blacks were excluded just as much as Irish people and Scottish people as well. So you had that sort of level of exclusion societally, socially. So there's only sort of certain pubs they know they could go to and be felt welcome. That's why they had their own parties and basically, you know, done their own thing. And so we had a very sort of diverse, eclectic mix of upbringing, having different friends and, you know, having Irish people and Scottish people who my dad's friends in particular. So I was aware and cognizant of those challenges that was going on. And obviously, as I got older, you know, you saw the issues then with the, they called it, then it was the National Front, who was the equivalent of the BNP. And you saw the presence that they had on the streets, particularly in areas like Lewisham, where it was very, very difficult, and they had a strong visibility. So you had to be careful. There were certain areas that you could just not go socially, you know, you just couldn't. And, you know, when we moved from Lewisham into Woolwich, you know, we didn't live far from where Stephen Lawrence, you know, was actually brutally murdered. So I was growing up in that area knowing that you could, there was just certain places that you just could not go, you know, because you were susceptible to being, you know, to meeting the wrong people at the wrong time. And I always had that instinct about that in football as well when I was young. When we used to play, you know, sometimes you used to get sort of called names, people referring to your ethnicity, using that to support you. But it's just ignorance, isn't it? Lack of education, ignorance, you know, vitriol. And obviously, you know, so that kind of, I suppose, gave me the awareness, the understanding, which is why I remember my mum always saying to me, Paul, you know, you've got to be twice as good to be even, to get the opportunity. And I think that's always, I've used that as a catalyst to fuel my motivation to go over and beyond. Because, you know, as I see with the work I'm sure we'll come on and talk that I've done over the last sort of 25, 30 years, everything that I've done, I can see now how it's played out through my life, from grassroots to the park, you know, and then the whole way it's come through the whole sort of footballing system and that unconscious bias and that, you know, the racism and some of the despicable verbal abuse that one experienced. But how it shaped me for life, it gave me that extra layer of skin, motivation, application, attitude, dedication and focus to really go for it with real vigour to fulfil my career dream. So I was aware of it, I was conscious of it, you know, there was abuse you were getting from other people. Yeah, I was a little bit naughty at times where I retaliated. Absolutely, I was a young boy, you know, but I was very lucky because I had two older brothers. So I was like the younger brother. So I was very protected as well. Although I was susceptible as well, I was protected as well. So I was very lucky. So we were, you know, we endured those challenges through that kind of schooling grassroots system. And obviously thereafter, you know, when my professional career started, wow, it went then to another. It went exponentially then, all the issues of race, because as we know, you know, it's a big issue in society. And it was those in society that, you know, that used to plant themselves in football stadiums, and black players of my generation, you know, we were the prime targets for all that vitriol and abuse.
Absolutely. And you, like you say, fans, obviously, fans represent society. So when you made that move into Charlton, obviously, as you said, you made your debut at 16. What was the environment like in the dressing room? Obviously, 16, young guy, and a young black guy in the team.
Yeah, I mean, I was quite lucky because, you know, Charlton had a history of, you know, pubs were always comfortable with Charlton. And remember, down the road was Millwall. And in fact, Millwall, in terms of having black players, Millwall were on the same level as Charlton. You had players, I remember that time, you had Phil Walker, who was a black player then, who was playing back in the 70s. He was kind of like one of my heroes. You had Trevor Lee, you know, and then latterly thereafter, they had John Fashanu as well. So, you know, Millwall, because if you go, to be quite frank, you know, where Millwall's sort of situated in an area called New Cross in southeast London, it's, you know, 99.9%, you know, black Asian, just 99% say black people that used to live there, but only those in the stadium were predominantly white, you know. So that said to you the power of the club, and obviously it probably evidenced the challenges that were there. And I think, you know, Charlton was a fabulous dressing room. I had one naughty experience, and I remember when, you know, we were having like an overnight stay, one of the very times that I stayed in a hotel. And I remember, you know, this was a sort of, it was ignorance, really. One of the players who I won't name his name, but he actually said to me, you know, should we get some Coon Flakes for Paul? So that was like in the morning when you were having breakfast. And if you're a young 16-year-old kid, that's very, very hurtful, you know. And I remember that was saying to me, whilst, you know, the whole environment was good, I really enjoyed the club, I liked the club, you still, in one or two individuals, you still had that bigoted, you know, antisocial, ignorant behaviours. And obviously, I realised that, in truth, that was really a real microcosm of the bigger experiences that I'd seen and in all the different playing environments that I saw, not just in society, but within football, within football clubs, within football stadiums.
Do you think that sort of environment, you know, intensified it? As you say, there wasn't the education like there is now, or what there should be now back then. Do you think the dressing room, the atmosphere intensified it?
In an extent, yes. But also there was the other side of the fence was that people didn't understand the boundaries of banter. You know, and I'm one, I laugh, I don't have an issue when I hear jokes about different things, but you have to think about your behaviours now. But then it was really a free-for-all because there was no boundaries, you know, and everybody deemed, I mean, there was a, you know, listen, I don't think, Amy, you were even born then, there was a programme there called Love Thy Neighbour, and that kind of perpetuated the racial stereotypes. And it was a TV programme, they used to use, you know, language that was very, very acceptable. And you had programmes with Alf Garnett, who was a historical West Ham supporter, and they were using language that was just the norm, and it was considered as the norm, which was really unpalatable, you know, at that juncture. But it became standardised, nuanced parlances that people used, and it was wholly acceptable. So then, you know, because nobody knew any better, but I knew as a black man it was offensive. But it's very hard for you to stand up and say, well, as a minority, hey, that's not right. But I had to do that eventually. And I did do that when you had more confidence in oneself. And also, you know, the influence that I made as my career evolved and I became a very successful footballer. So it was norm. It's a norm. It was just standardised, acceptable parlance at that juncture, at that living in that time, because nobody knew any better. And also in the stadiums, there wasn't a legislative framework. There wasn't the law that actually says such disgusting, reprehensible abuse is unlawful. This is against the law. This is, you know, if you are behaved, if you get caught in this way, you are going to be punished, whether ejection from the stadium. But none of that was there. It was basically, I call it quite soft, it's quite simple, it's like the Wild West, to be quite frank with you. But that hardened me, and people saying, well, you shouldn't have had to put up with that. Well, we didn't know any better. Look what my mum and dad, my grandmother, all the people that I love, look what they've ever had to put up in the previous generation. So I just saw that as, you know, well, Paul, you've just got to do that to get through to be the best you can be. And then I realised about you becoming a role model and people started to look up to you. So that was the other motivation as well. So all those sort of attitudes and behaviours, it gave me an extra steely resolve. But I was still human, still immature at 16, 17, you know, and you're out there getting, you know, abuse, you know, being spat at, you know, abuse from the supporters when you're in possession of the ball, monkey chanting, bananas thrown at you, coins thrown at you. It's a lot for a person to endure, let alone a very young person.
This week on The Marketer's Report, Patrizio Spagnoletto, Global Chief Marketing Officer, Direct-to-Consumer for Warner Brothers Discovery, weighs in on building trust.
Trust is a really hard thing to build and a really easy thing to destroy, and we have to be very respectful about that. Our partnership with iHeart has really helped us build that trust and that relationship with the on-air talent.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all, every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the data you need to grow. Go to iHeartResults.com for more. This week on The Marketer's Report, Patrizio Spagnoletto, Global Chief Marketing Officer, Direct-to-Consumer for Warner Brothers Discovery, weighs in on building trust.
Trust is a really hard thing to build and a really easy thing to destroy, and we have to be very respectful about that. Our partnership with iHeart has really helped us build that trust and that relationship with the on-air talent.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all, every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the data you need to grow. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Absolutely. And as you say, you did have a very successful career, and right from the off, you got a very big move. You went to Luton Town, first division club at that time. What was that like?
Amy, it was amazing, because I tell you the reason why, because, I mean, I've done great. I loved Charlton. It was my first club. And to be honest with you, it was very interesting, because there was rumours about that Arsenal wanted to buy me. And, you know, apparently they came to watch me, and I was so excited. And I remember there's a paper called The Evening Standard, which sort of covers all the London news. And it had in there, Arsenal preparing to make sort of a £400,000 bid for young Charlton starlet Paul Elliott. And I was like so excited when I saw my name in the paper. And obviously you believe that, you're not mature enough to understand all the nuances that go on and all the paper talk. And when Charlton, they had a lot of issues, financial problems. And, you know, when I heard that, you know, I remember it was Lenny Lawrence calling me into the dressing room and said to me, Paul, you know, we're dreadfully sorry, but we've had to sell you. There's a club that wants to buy you. You know, we're going to drive you to a hotel in Essex. And I'm thinking, it's Arsenal, it's Arsenal, it's Arsenal, it's Arsenal. I was terribly excited. I couldn't even sort of, you know, speak to my mum. So I'm in the car and he's saying, Paul, we're in trouble, blah, 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 blah. And then when I got to the hotel, he says, Paul, I'm going to tell you who the club is. And he says, it's Luton Town. And I felt like I felt like collapsing, to be honest with you. I'm thinking, damn, I want to come. But I have to say, you know, after listening to David Pleat, who was the manager then, I was 18 years of age. After 10 minutes, I knew this was the club I wanted to join. It was a wonderful club. And to be honest with you, oddly, I've kept all these years. That was over 30 years ago. And I spoke with David Pleat last week. We still keep in touch. I saw him at the Wembley FA Cup final. So we're friends. We text. And I said to him, David, you know, I've played for some big clubs. I've played for a lot of clubs. But I can't tell you how happy I was at Luton. Not just on the field, but off the field, in the dressing room. And I says, you created that culture. And it's quite interesting, Amy, because he was Jewish. So obviously he understood about the anti-Semitism, the challenges that he had. He was as a Jewish player, then becoming a Jewish manager. And then I remember one particular game, we had about eight black players with Luton Town playing against Sunderland, Southampton, sorry. And it was just, you know, unbelievable. You know, the people just thinking, you know, where's all this diversity come from? You know, all these black players. So David, he was very much a pioneer in his time, and he was one that he fought the fight. You know, he gave everybody the chances, equal opportunities, because that's what it was all about. You know, regardless of their race, colour, creed, religion, gender, disability, sexuality, etc. It's about giving equal opportunities, and David was just simply a wonderful man. So my time at Luton was brilliant, because we had about regularly playing with four or five players in the black. You know, so you had Ricky Hill, Brian Steen, Emeka Najobi, you had Ray Daniels, you had Mitchell Thomas, you know, myself. So that's not, you know, so to have that diversity in the dressing room. But it was a brilliant dressing room. You know, David created, it's all about culture. We talk about culture in football and working environments. We had an amazing culture in the football club, and that was done by David Pleat. So it's the most brilliant move, and I've got so much affection for that club.
I guess that's kind of what you're promoting now, you know, and we'll definitely come on to it later, but it's that culture, like you say. So David Pleat himself, Jewish, you have diversity within in the structure of the club. That was unknown back then.
Absolutely. Listen, he was the very, very first. I mean, you know, and I think we got beat in the game or whatever. It was probably all, you know, they say, no, it's all the black players' fault. We got beat, you know. But David, he, you know, when you talk about true game changers, and he had to be brave to do that, you know, because he would have been under a lot of pressure. And Luton was a very diverse local community, but... You know, it was he was a very, very brave man, and that's how you change culture. And when, as you say, I was having a conversation with the English FA, where I was in a board meeting, and we're talking about we have to change culture for organisations to evolve. You know, like governing bodies, institutions in business, charity, you know, across football. You know, it's all about culture. You get the culture right, and there's a wonderful domino effect. If the culture's wrong, you will not be successful. And it's the same with football. And so, you could have the wrong culture off the field, and that will permutate itself into the dressing room and also onto the field of play. And great managers like Sir Alex Ferguson, great managers like, you know, Jock Steen, you know, what they've done, they created great cultures in the dressing room. And it's like the golden thread that runs throughout the whole of the club from, you know, the little lady that used to come and clean, you know, clean the boots, you know, do all the cleaning, all the mundane tasks. They had as much self-importance as your number nine striker. Everybody was treated the same and equitably. And you find that all the big clubs, that's why Sir Alex and Jock Steen, who are great sort of heroes of mine, they were not just great managers, but great people because of where they come from and the humility and their background. So culture for me is critical to success. I don't know a team yet that's got a bad culture and a successful.
You talk about great people, and I think that's a perfect blend into your next move. You were at Aston Villa, and you were under the great Billy McNeil.
Yeah, big Billy. I mean, what a great man he was. And I remember, you know, he came at the club in a kind of, it's like a period of transition, to be quite honest with you. And I think then, yeah, he had already left Celtic, went down to, yeah, he left Celtic, went Man City, then come to Aston Villa. And, you know, it was challenging, but it was, you know, this man had a presence. My goodness me. You know, when he come out, you know, his big barrel chest, you know, sticking out, you know, and we had a fantastic relationship. And it was just great because he was a centre-half, well, a world-class centre-half, a leader. And obviously, I couldn't have had any better. I couldn't have had a better role model to learn from, to support me, to mentor me, to show me, to impact with me. And it was great. So obviously, you know, things didn't work out. Things weren't fantastic for him on the field. But Villa was a big club, a huge club, very diverse fan base. And it was a period of transition because they had so much success in the 80s when they won the European Cup. So, you know, someone like Big Billy, to be fair, he was just the right person, you know, possibly at the wrong time because you're in that period of transition. And transition, you need patience, you know. And football is a relentless business. You don't get the patience and the time you want. So, you know, but it was great for me to engage with him, work alongside him, and obviously build a relationship with him because it was on the back of that relationship that obviously we reconnected when I'd done my time in Italy and obviously went to Celtic.
Absolutely. So you touched on it there. What attracted you to Italy? You know, I think even now, and again, we'll touch upon it, there's a societal racism even to a greater extent in Italy. So what took you out there?
I was young, only 23. You know, I always say I went there a boy and come back a man. And I think at that time, I mean, Italy was easily, it was the equivalent of the Premier League today.
Yeah.
It was the number one league in the world. I remember, You know, my first game was against AC Milan. You know, you had Hullet, Van Basten, Rijkaard, Maldini, Baresi, Costa Corta. I mean, I could tell you the whole team, you know. And then my second game was against Naples, against Napoli. I marked Maradona. I remember all my family coming over to watch me in Italy play against Maradona. You know, the third game we played against Juventus. I was marking Ian Rush then because he. So, you know, you were playing against players, the best players in the world, at the peak of their careers. So for me, I was so honoured, you know, to be this young, you know, black boy from Southeast London, from Lewisham, come through the ranks, forged a professional career. You know, I was just thinking sort of Charlton, Luton, Aston Villa. And then when Pisa came calling, I'm thinking, well, they were very, in many respects, it reminded me of Luton because they got promoted from Serie B. Just like when I went to Luton then, who were then in the first division, they got promoted from Division 2. So there was that continuity in the squad where there was all young players, all come locally. And Pisa was very much like that. It was a great club, a great time. And the other foreign player was a guy called Carlos Dunga, who was the Brazilian player, Brazilian manager. Because at that time, each club could... Amy could only have two foreign players. So I felt really special, you know, to make me feel, well, they chose me. I was one of the chosen ones. And how the move come about, they watched me actually when I was at Aston Villa because they were very interested in Mark Walters. We had a friendly Pisa against Aston Villa. We went out to Italy and Mark, he had some problems with his hamstrings and it just so happens that I just sort of flourished. And then they came back. They were watching me over a period of 3 or 4 months. And during that time, I recall playing against Kenny Dalglish, Mark Hughes, Kerry Dixon, Gary Lineker, Graham Sharp, and Ian Rush, critically, who Juventus had a pre-contract to sign for 3.5 million. So they're thinking, well, we've seen this guy. I had a purple patch. I mean, let's just say I had a great 2 months. And that was the catalyst to the move.
You touched upon some great names there. What are your memories of Hullet, Maradona, Ian Rush? Like you say, they are in their prime.
Yeah, and you know Hullet, he was unbelievable because he's built like a middleweight boxer. I mean, he had this stature, he had this presence, this authority on the pitch. And he's probably one of the very few players in the world that I've seen. You've got your Ronaldos and your Messis and your Maradonas. He's obviously at that level. He could be effective anywhere on the pitch, but he had a great work ethic. And that was the start of the great, you know, AC Milan team. And then Van Basten simply, in terms of the centre forward, he arguably was, you know, for me, the best centre forward of all, one of the best. I mean, he's probably the best centre forward I've ever, ever, ever played. He had everything: height, stature, speed, technical ability, tremendous movement, aggressive, great team player. And Maradona, I mean, it was like, I got sent off actually because I clumped Maradona on the halfway line. I got a red card actually. So I was a bit naughty, got a red card. But playing against him, it's like he had magic in his feet. Magic. He didn't know what he was doing. Had a low sense of gravity. He just had this unbelievable repertoire of skill sets, you know. And I know when we were playing them previously in the warm up, he had his own physio. He was warming up, and he was like, you know, playing keep me up with two oranges, you know, doing all these skills with the two oranges simultaneously. I mean, it was like just mass, you know, entertainment. So he was just spectacular, the phenomenal. So. So I suppose I was so privileged to, you know, to be in that company, and more importantly, you know, make a positive contribution on behalf of Pisa, and so I really felt that my whole game, technically, tactically, I was more mature. I learned to speak the language. I integrated myself into the culture, which is very important. You know, could speak fluent Italian after sort of 7 or 8 months. And I loved my 2 years there, to be quite frank. And also got many friends still. My best friend, you know, a guy called Luca Ciccone, you know, he was the very first guy I met 35 years ago, got introduced to, you know, we text each other, I WhatsApp him, you know, 3 days ago. So, you know, those relationships are brilliant, very important, significant relationships. And I went back just before lockdown. It was about 6 months before lockdown. they opened a museum in Pisa, and they asked me to go and opened it. And it was, you know, you make you feel so, so welcome.
Yeah.
So it was brilliant. Wonderful.
I think in recent times, you know, there's been quite a lot of attention on the way that how racism is still so prevalent in the Italian game. You know, there's been Moise Keane, Mario Balotelli, Romelu Lukaku. So it's still so prevalent now. Why do you feel that, you know, there have been advancements here, and we'll definitely come on to that. It's not an issue that's been cured or solved, but we've made advancements and we've made improvements. But Italy, it doesn't quite seem the case.
It's a very challenging environment, Italy, because I think the problem is there's a lot of, you know, you've got obviously the ultras, you've got that sort of fascist side of the attitudes. And these, a lot of those people, they've got tremendous power. It's the what they've done, they've got a toxic mix of the politics, you know, in the, and that creates a lot of that extremist type of behaviour. And it was evident to me, and that's why historically, for the beauty, I mean, Italy, I can't say to you, I've been very lucky to travel the world. It's probably one of the most beautiful countries in the world. Yeah. The people, the food, you know, everything about the country, the culture, that side of the culture, the historical buildings, very warm. And I know that I was very fortunate because I went there as a eminent, prominent footballer. But then if you go 600 metres from the stadium, then you see the other ugly side of, you know, for the beauty, you see great social deprivation, you see, you know, a lot of the immigration. And to be quite frank, Italy, like a lot of other countries, they've got that racism, that internalised racism within their own culture, because you've got the north, which is very prosperous, very affluent, and you've got the south, where there's a lot of social deprivation and a lot of poverty. And they've got yellow skin Italians in the south, and you've got the northern, which is like more white, you know, like your complexion, say, Amy. And what they do, the north call the south Africans.
Yeah.
So that, you know, dysfunctional culture is embedded. It's embedded in the fabric of their culture. So when you've got that, you know, their own against each other, you know, what chance does somebody, you know, who's of a darker shade of skin gonna have? So I was just lucky, because obviously I went there as a footballer, so I was treated well. You know, you're looked after, so you're not really susceptible to a lot of those kind of social and cultural challenges. You know, I was very closeted in that context, but obviously that was only closeted until I got on the field of play. You know, I've got a lot of abuse, a lot of issues in obviously Italy, but I soon realised the issues of racism, discrimination, prejudice, you know, it comes in all different guises and forms. And it's, you know, it's throughout the whole world, but obviously it manifests a lot around football, because football is the vehicle and the catalyst for those right-wing extremists to launch their recruitment drives. It was the same in the UK. You know, the National Front, the BNP, they've done the same thing. And it's also happened in Italy. So, you know, it was prevalent. Let's be honest with you. That was that political alignment. You know, they've all got their political engagement with their respective party. That was a prominent part of football. That's the reality of the situation.
Absolutely. And as you see, the discrimination comes in many forms. You make the move to Glasgow, obviously. Billy McNeil is a deciding factor. Were there other clubs interested at you at that time? Like you say, you're coming to a good age. You've got a fantastic career behind you. Who else were the sort of clubs interested?
Well, I know because Brian Clough was then at Nottingham Forest. He was very interested in signing me. So was QPR and so was West Ham. They were the three clubs that expressed a serious level of interest. And Chelsea were kind of hovering around as well. But to be honest with you, I mean, it was Mark Walters. You know, Mark was my best mate in football. We played together at England. We played at Aston Villa, and we always, you know, went out socially. And he rang me, and then when it was, you know, there was some rumour factory, you know, I got some calls from some journalists in Scotland, and that just said, listen, you know, big man, you know, what do you think? You know, I've heard that Celtic are interested in you, blah, 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 blah. I said, Celtic? Really? You know, I'm thinking, wow. So I just thought at that juncture, You know, I was.
This week on The Marketer's Report, Patrizio Spagnoletto, Global Chief Marketing Officer, Direct to Consumer for Warner Brothers Discovery, weighs in on building trust.
Trust is a really hard thing to build and a really easy thing to destroy. And we have to be very respectful about that. Our partnership with iHeart has really helped us build that trust and that relationship with the on-air talent.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the data you need to grow. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
25, you know, still had another 5 years, you know. So I thought, well, yeah, I could go back to say England, back to then the first division, but look at the experience I would have missed out. I knew about Celtic, you knew about Jock Stein, Billy McNeil, you know, the history of the club, the tradition of the club. And also I remember growing up, sort of, and also in my career, I knew in London you had like the Celtic supporters clubs. You know, there were some in South London, some in Kilburn, and that was the alignment with the Irish community, you know. So I knew that they existed. So I knew that, you know, Celtic was really bigger than a football club. It's like an institution. So my instinct said, because I had that kind of nomadic instinct in me, you know, left home when I was young, went to, you know, Luton Town, big move, Aston Villa, big move, Celtic, big move. I thought, well, at 25, let's go to Scotland, let's go to Glasgow. And let's be honest, quite frankly, I absolutely adored my time in Glasgow. In Scotland, and more importantly, I love the people. It's the values, the integrity, the humour. It was just off the scale for me. I just love the humour, and for all the challenges that I had, obviously with the racist abuse, it was superseded by the most wonderfulest, kindness, funniest people that I've ever come across, with a great sense of integrity. I loved it. I loved it.
You do mention Mark Walters, and actually just last night I watched the documentary where he talks through obviously his time at Rangers, and you know, it's the first time I've seen his first game. His debut was a derby, an Old Firm derby, and the bananas are getting thrown on. Then yeah. There's the week after he plays Hearts, and there's coins getting thrown as well as the bananas. Yeah. How does he sell it to you then? What brings you there? You know, that's one of your best friends. You're aware, yeah. He's went through that. How does he sell that?
Because I think we were both mature enough. We had a grown up conversation. I says, Mark, I says, am I going to get grief up there? He says, big man, everywhere you go, you're going to get grief because that's the world. But he says the good supersedes the bad, and to be honest with you, he was very open, and I just thought, well. I knew he was getting that kind of grief. So I'm thinking at that point, you know, you've got a top player who's a black player at Rangers. I could become that equivalent at Celtic. And then we could use the power of that to try and make that social change through the power of football. So be assured that future strategy, you know, because I'd like to feel I've done the same in Italy. You know, I went there, challenging circumstances. People look at you, and then you leave there saying, you know, they're looking at you now as a through football, as a good footballer, but also a good human being, and demonstrating to people, well, you don't judge people, you know, by the colour of their skin. Judge them by the content of their character, their hearts, their behaviours. So there's that sort of byproduct of that kind of that education to mobilise people and using your own power. You don't realise it at the time, but by being successful, Amy, that gives you a platform, it gives you confidence, people then approach you, and then you can use that platform to talk about the other issues, you know, and you have to be brave to do that, you know, because obviously, you know, I've been criticised, and there's no problems with criticism, because people don't want to hear people with power and influence trying to make change. They've got their own agenda. But really, you know, people realise that what I was doing was using my power wisely, judiciously and constructively to make change and bring people on the journey. So I can see where Mark was coming from, but in many respects, the more he said that, I thought about all my previous moves and my kind of legacy in that sense, you know. And I think, well, imagine if I could go to Scotland and have a similar impact as a footballer on the field of play and then use that leverage, you know, to talk about and challenge the other issues around racism and bigotry.
Absolutely. And it was more than a successful stint at Celtic for yourself. The club, perhaps not so much. What did you know, obviously, Jock Stein and Billy McNeil, but at that time, who were you impressed with as your teammates? You know, like you say, it was a tricky time for the side.
I mean, Paul Mustaine. I mean, I remember when I was a kid growing up in southeast London, in Lewisham, and I remember watching this programme about Jack the Hat McVitie, you know, and I remember watching a programme about Paul Mustaine, and he must have been about 16, 17. And I remember Inter Milan were trying to sign him, you know, and they said they were prepared to pay then about £300,000-£500,000, which is just an astronomical amount of money.
Big money.
And I remember him. I mean, he played for Scotland, you know, under 15, schoolboys, right the way through. And they were saying that this guy is going to be the next world, you know, international superstar, you know. And he was so revered. So he was one that I watched. So I knew he was obviously at Scotland, in Scotland playing for Celtic. And I knew of, you know, Big D, Derek White. You had Josie Miller. You know, you had John Hewitt, who was a left winger, very talented player. And I then remember that Darius Jackanowski was a great, you know, when he come from Poland, he's one of my best mates and we're still in touch today. And he was a really top player. And then Darius Dobchek. So all of a sudden, it was like an international diverse dressing room. And again, that was a period of transition. So, I mean, I loved the boys. They were great lads, great set of lads. You know, Chris Morris, Anton Rogan, Paddy Bonner. You know, they're great. You know, I know Peter Grant, you know, Granty, you know. So it was a fabulous dressing room and a great set of lads. And I, to be honest with you, I mean, what I really loved, I mean, I loved the big games, you know, with Rangers, and I was very lucky because, I mean, Rangers, I mean, again, you know, I could pick off their team. I mean, I knew Souness was a good lad, but, you know, you had sort of Terry Butcher, Richard Gough, John Brown, Bomber Brown, you know, you had the fullback, Gary was at Everton, you had Trevor Stephen, Gary Stephen, you had, you know, who else was there? Trevor Hurlock. You know, up front you have obviously Mo Johnston, Ali McCoys, Mark Haitley. So, you know,
rattles them off.
You just don't. And they were the most brilliant games I loved playing in the Old Firm, because I loved playing on a big stage, on the big platform, because that was your time for me, you know, to make your name. So I loved it, you know, and I love, yeah, you know, the intensity of the social thing. You've got the two biggest clubs in Scotland within a 3-mile radius. But I love the intensity of that. I love the intensity of the pressure of the big games, the media build-up, the games itself, and then thereafter socially. So it was absolutely magnificent, you know. And obviously, you know, winning the Scottish Player of the Year, the first black player to win that, and that was very important because that sets the trend. Because I think about, 3 or 4 months ago, I'd done some pieces to camera, you know, with Sky, about the Old Firm, and looking at the whole diversity. And I was like one of the first prominent, you know, black individuals to play for Celtic. And diversity now is fixture and fitting in the Scottish game. So that's the evolution, you know, of diversity and how the clubs, the brilliant work that both Celtic and Rangers and others do in the community, how it's really paid dividends to welcome people to Scotland and Glasgow.
I see, you thrived on the big stage, and with a big stage brings a big crowd. You touched on as well, Jackanowski, the European nights, I think, of that, the Partizan Belgrade game. You know, it's still not enough to put Celtic through, but how much did you revel in, you know, the fans, the hundreds of thousands of fans?
My goodness, I mean, I could imagine how, you know, thinking about the lockdown. Imagine, I know the suffering of all the fans, but I think about supporters like Celtic who are just totally immersed in the culture of the club. So I don't know how they've suffered. I don't know how they've managed in this brutal adversity. But the supporters, that's where it was a way of life. You know, we've touched on culture. Celtic is a culture. Celtic is a way of life. There is a way, there is a manner, there is a behaviour, there is an attitude, there is a sincerity. There's an engagement, there's a movement Celtic is a movement of a culture that embraces all the good things about people, attitudes, behaviours. You know, if the other person hasn't got a lot, somebody will break off their so-and-so and help. You know, it's a culture of sharing, of respect, of humanity, of decency. All the good things in that you want from people and human and social behaviours. And that's what really struck a chord with me. And that's why I think, you know, I kind of really galvanised towards that, you know, because I knew that it was special. It's like, I mean, if you could bottle it and it'd be worth billions of pounds, because the club's a global brand, isn't it? It's a global brand, Celtic. And it's that culture that has created that brand, that specialness. I mean, I think Liverpool's got it. I think Celtic's got it. I think Rangers. Now, there's certain kind of clubs, they have that cult. They have that. And Celtic, unequivocally, globally, they've got that. They've got such this nice way about them, you know, that I just find, I think a lot of people have that in the North anyway, to be honest with you, because there's a different social demographic and upbringing, and you have different type of values, you know, that I don't necessarily always see in other areas of the country. So that really struck a chord with me, you know, that really did. And I just couldn't understand the intensity, how their whole life was central in the football club. You know, everything that went on in the football club was the key component in the DNA of their life. You know, so their social, you know, their personal, you know, their working life, you know, all the areas of their life, Celtic was that, you know, when we talk about, I say, my work, equality, diversity and inclusion, EDI has got to be that central theme and embedded in the culture. That's got to be the golden thread for our football organisations, businesses. You know, that's the same way I felt about the Celtic culture. It was embedded in the whole of the DNA. And it was remarkable, remarkable, extraordinary, to be quite frank.
You talk about the legacy that you've left pretty much at every club you've played for, and you say that they are obviously Player of the Year. Trailblazer is a big word, but how that ultimately is what you were, being the first black man to win that. How much pride do you hold in that?
Massive, massive. Because it was a very, I mean, you're talking in 1989, wasn't it? You know, when I arrived, and because I suppose I looked at it, I reflected on my upbringing, my journey in the game, and I think I've sort of taken on similar types of those principles with the work that I do. The first, say, black person to sit on the FA board and chair a board, and, you know, and the FA counts, you know, because I wanted to make that transition. But it's pride, isn't it? Because I think, while supporters, I mean, I know I won numerous sort of Player of the Year, Celtic Player of the Year, but when you speak to a professional footballer, an ex-professional footballer, you know, the respect of the people you work with or compete against is arguably the most important respect. That I was lucky I had both, but I talk as an elite sportsman, you know, that the people that you compete and participate with and against, their opinions of you is the most important opinion, you know, more than journalists, arguably more than supporters, you know, because there could be a number of reasons why supporters don't like somebody, you know, but your fellow professional brethren, their consideration and estimation of you is the most important psychological and professional emotional feeling. That's the most important thing to me. As a man and a player.
An asset to the country, to the league, you know, a shining light in the team where there wasn't many lights at that time. Is there anything that Celtic could have done to keep you, to save you moving down south?
Because, you know, I had obviously there was some challenges I had with the board, and then these things happen, everybody falls out, you know, you fall out with teammates, media, you know. But I think, if I'm being honest with you, it was all about timing. You know, I was 27, you know, and to be honest, Amy, I had four or five big moves then, because if you, and I think you probably might understand, you know, most centre halves, you know, like a Roy Aitken, like a Tommy Burns, you know, I'll just use them for example, you know, particularly as defenders, you'd stay at one club for 10 years, wouldn't you? Billy McNeil, you'd have your whole career at one club. But I had this nomadic, interesting, eclectic mix of moves in different cultures, in different environments, different working environments. And I think that was, and it was so, it was unheard of. Defenders in my generation would never move, you know, only midfield players or forwards would move with that frequency like they do today, you know. But that was very uncharacteristic. And I just felt at that time, 27, you know, peak of my game, you know, had two fabulous years, you know, and that was just the time for me to go back home to London. And obviously the Chelsea thing was a perfect situation because they were a big club, a huge club, you know, under-tap club. And one of my biggest, you know, satisfaction, I suppose, or achievements at Celtic, that Chelsea was being their first black captain. Because again, Chelsea, back in the, you know, the 70s, I remember playing against Chelsea in really challenging circumstances as a 16, 17-year-old boy and getting absolutely, you know, the abuse was just reprehensible. So to have seen the evolution of Chelsea, you know, Ken Bates was a great man, a great owner, really liked him. And then obviously, you know, the following year, sort of the Premier League started. So Chelsea, in many respects, was going from that kind of domestic, sort of toxic area into an international global brand that attracted your Ruud Gullits, Glenn Hoddles, Gianluca Vialis. The fan base was then, it was an international global club. So, you know, that was so attractive. I inherit, you know, so, yeah, but it was great satisfaction. So I really, and I think if I look at my move, every move I made, there's obviously a right footballing imperative behind that. But I think there was a social and an ethical and a moral imperative behind the moves as well for the impact to challenge the social norms and all the issues and the challenges that I had through leveraging my power as a leader, you know, as a centre half, as the captain of the field, to lead, to drive, to inspire. And that obviously reverberates and impacts people as well. So I kind of feel that everything that happened to me, you don't know it at the time, but that journey was meant to happen because that gave me the seamless transition into the work that I'm doing now, you know. So now I'm no longer can talk on the field of play, but I talk in front of TV cameras, I talk in boards, councils, committees, you know, to make that difference. So the very same continuity of messaging from the field of play as a leader, as an example, as you know, I've got that continuity in my DNA, but doing it in a different way, in a more meaningful way, probably, where you need to make those changes to get greater diversity, inclusion and equality, you know, into football, you know, from the boardrooms, you know, into football business, into, you know, into boards, councils, committees, community jobs. So that whole inclusion and diversity is such a critical, and that's been exemplified by the last 14 months and George Floyd and everything that's gone on and all the issues that I have, the challenges that I have, you know, that many people have experienced around institutional, structural, systematic racism, social inequalities. All that has come out in the world. And I travelled the world, you know, as a young player, seeing all that, experiencing all that, but then it's sort of the manifestation of that, you know, in the world itself, you know, through what's gone on by this, you know, poor man that brutally murdered, and the good that's going to come from that. So, you know, that's been this unbelievable journey. So, you know, I always said if you know, I think there's a lot more miles left. I'm still a relatively young man, but if everything my life stopped tomorrow, I'd be happy. But I don't. I want more life because I've got lots to do, more people to change, to affect, to challenge, to mobilise, to lead, and to make continual change.
Talking about change, and like you say, that is epitomises everything you're trying to do. So mirroring almost your move to Chelsea at that time as well, you rightly mentioned, probably back in that time there was a real link with Chelsea and the National Front. But you mentioned a name there in Ken Bates. Does that sort of, you know, emulate that it is people who can cause change and people make change? It's not policy, it's the people. So him coming in he was brought Chelsea that next step forward.
Ken was brilliant. I mean, he got a lot of grief for supporting black players. He used to get bullets in the post and a lot of things. And he told me, he said to me, "Paul, I want you to be my captain, be my first black captain, you know." And you made a point there before, Eamon, and this is what I try and say to people when I'm talking on a wider political level. It's not policy that makes frame or the framework of policy. It's people and people doing the right thing. And Ken Bates has done, you know, he might have upset a few other people. I don't doubt it, you know, with Batesy, I call him, you know, Uncle Ken. But you know what? He has been unbelievably loyal and magnificent towards me. And the opportunities and the support that he's given me has been immense. So I, you know, he is living now in Monaco and, you know, enjoying his life. And, you know, it's people like that. And that's why it's those people with the power that use the power. You know, that's so important, people using power, not for self, use the power to make change, you know, and bring people on the journey and make a difference and make people's lives better, more equitable, and provide better opportunities in the workplace and opportunities for people, you know, through sport. So, you know, that's why the work that I do now, my relationships, I make change through my relationships with people, you know, people that's got that empathy, people that, you know, you can take on that journey, and people that trust you, you know, because they know with me, I'll always do the right thing for football. You know, I call myself a change agent, you know, I'm a change agent, an agent of change. That's what I do, because it's the right thing to do. But there's a lot of good people out there that's also doing some brilliant work, and I co-partner with them on my journey. So it's great.
You know, it is all about changing, as you say. So 30 years ago, if it be you or if it be Mark Walters, you're singling out because it's the one black man on the pitch, you know. And I'll use my own experience here. I watch Celtic, I watch down south, I watch any football game, and I would never, and it would never even occur to me, bat an eyelid to even think if it's a black player, if it's a white player, because to me it's all just the same. So as you say, it's that changes came in on the pitch, and that is fantastic, because it's not viewed any differently. But what is the issue in the boardrooms, you know, and in senior management? How do we get that diversity there? What's going wrong?
That's been the biggest single challenge, because obviously, and I should also say in Scotland, people like Fraser Wishart has been doing a brilliant job. Tony Higgins, I only spoke with them last week. We're talking about the challenges and giving them support. So that's, you know, I call my Scottish brethren, my Scottish partners. So they're great guys, you know, and JP. So that's the, you know, the big taboo now, because I think the problem is, and this is football, it's built on those old networks, you know. And part of my job is to sort of say to those, you know, I'm sort of like, you know, you have to change, you know, because this, you know, there's evidence, there's data out there. You've got to modernise your organisations. Football clubs are global brands. And then there's the economic imperative. In my political argument, I actually say when the Premier League started in 1992, the TV rights was worth 192 million for the domestic rights, 40 million for the international rights. Fast forward 30 years, the domestic rights is worth close to 5 billion and the international rights are worth 3 billion. So the last cycle was worth 3 billion, was worth 8 billion pounds. And the reason is because, you know, in the Premier League now, you've got 61% of the players are foreign. And the Premier League is shown now in 188 countries worldwide. So the Premier League, its whole business model, Amy, is built on one thing, diversity. So when I say to people, that's the economic upside of having a diverse and inclusive work field on the field of play. Don't you think then your board, you know, so your chairman or your vice chairman or your senior executive, your commercial manager, you know, shouldn't you be having that same principles of that diversity on the field? Because look at your audience. Your audience is no longer, you know, the 60 million people in the UK or the X amount of people in Scotland. It's global. You know, it's over Asia, Africa, you know, North and Central America, China, you know. So you must understand there's the economic imperative of a diverse and inclusive workforce, as well as the social imperative as well, to do the right thing, because diversity is good. Diversity of thinking is very, very important, because you can't have all Paul Elliott's on the board, but you can't have also all Amy's on the board. Yeah. You can have a bit of Amy, a bit of Paul Elliott, a bit of somebody else, to have diverse thinking. And that's how you learn. You know, you learn when you talk to people from diverse backgrounds, different cultures, think differently, do differently. How do you empower and engage and mobilize so that you become a more worldly, a more effective, efficient individual? And boards are more effective and efficient because of the diversity of the personnel. They bring difference, you know. And I've seen it at the FA board, you know, where it's more effective and efficient, better decision makers, you know, corporate governance, more, you know, transparency, more fairness, more openness, because of the diversity of the board. That's what it brings. And so you've got the social narrative, and you've got the human narrative, and you've got the business narrative. And that's where, you know, through my work with the FA, I've created this diversity code, a leadership diversity code, where all the clubs have signed up to the code. So they're going to have targets, targets in the boardroom, targets in middle management, targets for senior leadership positions, targets for women in boards, women doing coaching, you know, minority ethnic groups, you know, more transparency on the recruitment, more diverse panels. So it's not about talking anymore. It's about putting a framework in place, you know, because the knee, the Black Lives Matter, the knee, I think it's so important. Amy, because the modern day players, it's a symbol to them. It's a sign of unity. It's their sign of engagement. It's they have a correlation and a relationship with that model. But now that still should continue. But then you have to have a cogent, coherent, you know, structure within the organization that holds football clubs to account. That's the action. This is the lobby, the visibility, the empowerment, but this is the action plan that holds football to account, and football's got to evolve and grow and be far more diverse.
Thinking back to, obviously, the incident that happened in the Charlton dressing room with a teammate, mm-hmm. and then you fast forward 30 years now, as you say, you're seeing players, and not just black players, white players, standing with their black players or kneeling with their black players. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you as a black man, as a former black footballer, seeing that connection, seeing that unity?
You know what, Amy, so in my opinion, that's arguably the most potent, powerful message, because in my dressing room, in my world, I was alone.
Yeah.
People didn't know how to cope with it. They didn't understand. So it's big. They just think, because Paul, you're 6'2", built like a middleweight boxer, you know, you're all right, big man, you know. But I have a heart. I have thoughts. I have feelings like everybody else. I have weaknesses. I have strengths. So I'm no different, you know, because of my physicality or my leadership, or, you know. So, in my opinion, you know, when I see down in the UK, what I done, when I created a structure, I had like my football board, I had a coaches board, football board, administrators board, you know, female coaches, diverse coaches. On my football board, you know, to contribute into the code was Jordan Henderson, Harry Kane, Tyrone Mings, Wes Morgan, Lucy Bronze, best woman player in the world, Leah Williamson, Nikita Paris. So that captured that diversity. So I'm imagine, you know, those black players now, you've got Jordan Henderson, Harry Kane, England captain, Tottenham captain, Liverpool captain, England vice captain alongside you saying, this is wrong. We are standing shoulder to shoulder. We are standing with the utmost solidarity and respect alongside our brothers, our footballers. Amy, that for me is the most powerful medium for change, that the black players now, not just white players, they've got everybody, international players, women, that same diversity on the pitch, they're all standing shoulder to shoulder in the fight and show a sign of unity and solidarity. That's the most powerful movement, because that's visible then, isn't it? That
Absolutely.
Visibility.
You know, Paul Elliott can't be in his role forever as much as we'd like him to be. And I'm not saying anytime soon that he's disappearing. But how much hope does that, that's it for you for the future? You know, you mentioned Tyrone Mings there, the great work he's doing, Troy Deeney, Marcus Rashford. But crucially, as you say, it's your white counterparts, it's Harry Kane, it's your Jordan Henderson's moving forward. How much hope do you have that, you know, we've came a long way in 30 years, but by no means is this over?
No, I mean, it's funny because I was listening to a former player and it was interesting. I mean, he was said, until you change society with racism, you're never going to change football.
Yeah. I
would reverse it back. I would say, if there's 7 billion people in the world, and within that 7 billion people, 4.5 billion people are watching the Premier League, and the EFL is the fifth most watched league in the world, if you can change football, and the Premier League's in 188 countries worldwide, wouldn't you say there's a consideration, if you can use the power of football to make the change, given the impact and the prominence and the eminence and the visibility of football and what it means to the world, you're going to have a better chance to say change society more than changing society first and thereafter as a byproduct changing football? That's my analogy. That's my rationale. I think, and that's where football is not responsible for all of societal ills, and that, but you know, football's got a massive role to play, and that's why clubs like Celtic, Rangers, they're doing some brilliant work in the roots of the community. Aberdeen, Hearts, Dundee, all relative to their local communities, they do some brilliant work, and that's using the power of football to activate and mobilise and change and evolve the communities. So I think that's the way you do it. You can get football right. You're always going to have people, as you've correctly, you know, the biggest challenge now is the social media, you know, with all the criticisms towards black players, women, but the government are on that, you know. We're doing a lot of work down here, and that was one of the conversations I was having with the guys, you know, in Scotland about, you know, our joint collaboration, because that's what we do, share knowledge, share ideas, share best practice. So for me, it's an easier fix to fix football than what it is to fix society. Fix football, and then the domino effect is you can really impact society. So no, I'm an optimist.
No, not at all, and well, rightly so. You know, we're coming up towards the Euros. Obviously, they're coming to the UK. In comparison, obviously, to like we say, to even to Italy, how proud are you to see, like you say, these figures, your Tyrone Mings and your Jordan Hendersons, they have put this country and football in such great stead. So no matter what the Euros brings, well, no matter what, you know, challenges could be thrown and faced with us, we're sitting in good stead, aren't we?
Yes, and also I say that for England, but I also have to say to you, I've got to pay tribute to Scotland as well.
Absolutely.
Steve Clark is a great mate of mine. We played together at Chelsea. The work that he has done as an individual, putting his head above the parapet, setting the example, took a lot of stick, as you know, because when you do brave and big things, he's a principled man, Steve. Quiet, unassuming, top guy, very principled. So I think it's great, that solidarity there. And you look at, to answer your question, what the guys are doing down south. And that's been exemplified by Gareth Southgate, great man, great manager, like Steve Clark. So we've got that, you know, we've got that new generation of player, but we've got the same with the next generation of managers as well. And I think it would be fantastic. And to have, you know, we've got 7 games, you know, down in at Wembley, which will be great. And obviously, I'm hopeful to be there to watch Scotland against England. That would be just fantastic. So I'm, you know, I think that having had the experiences I've had, the journey that I've lived, you can go through in my world, you can say, am I really going to bury my head in half empty, or am I going to do it in the half full end? And my life, my leadership, my attitude to change, my attitude to bringing people with me, you know, is always about the half full end. Take people on the journey, because it's easy to say what's wrong, but isn't it even better to say what's right and this is how we fixed it?
Absolutely. Paul, I cannot thank you enough. This has been an absolute honour to talk to you for over an hour, and I could speak to you for so many more. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I know I speak on behalf of many, many Celtic fans that you know, you're so loved up here. You really are. And I thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, I'm honoured. That's why, you know, I'm happy to give up my time to great people like you, your country, because you want to, you know, I have to, you're one of my disciples now, you know, you have to lobby, you know, you're fighting the cause for women as well, for the issues around, you know, gender discrimination, because it's about all forms of discrimination. We just have to speak about ethnicity, but it's also about your gender, about your disability, about your sexuality. So it's all about all those things where people just want to live, you know, to capture where we're coming from. I always say, you know, regardless of, you know, race, colour, creed, religion, gender, disability, sexuality, age, equality of opportunity is a fundamental God-given right. It's no privilege. So that's the best way to end. Thank you to all your listeners. You know, everybody keep working together because, you know, another line I always say, you know, alone we do so little, together everyone achieves more. T-E-A-M. Scotland now have got a team on the pitch.
Now, good time.
You know, England's got a team on the pitch. Now, you know, we have to build the same positive team with the same types of people to make change within the structures of football and the rub-on effect in society and community. So thank you all and thank you to everybody.
Paul Elliott, thank you for joining me on Soccer Supernova.
Message and data rates may apply. Guys, got hair loss? I know what you're thinking. Should I shave my head, comb it over, wear a hat? Just stop. This isn't 1970. Keep your hair and your confidence because Bosley, America's number one hair restoration experts, can give you your real hair back permanently. Check them out today because they're giving away an absolutely free information kit and a free gift card to anyone that texts EASY to 203203. Dude, you don't have to look like your dad, because this isn't your dad's hair loss treatment. People all over the country trust Bosley because they're ahead of the curve. They use the latest technology to give you your real hair back. And the best part? Bosley's permanent solution is protected by the Bosley Guarantee. Let Bosley show you for free how awesome your hair could look with an absolutely free information kit and a gift card for $250 off. Text EASY to 203203. That's EASY to 203203.
It's the Marketer's Report. This week, Patrizia Spagnoletto, Global Chief Marketing Officer, Direct to Consumer for Warner Brothers Discovery, weighs in on the difficult task of building and retaining consumer trust.
Trust is a really hard thing to build and a really easy thing to destroy, and we have to be very respectful about that. Our partnership with iHeart has really helped us build that trust and that relationship with the on-air talent. The best thing for us to do is to build a relationship with our consumers. And if those consumers have a relationship with the DJs that are on air, then we want to build on that. House of the Dragon, which was one of our most successful, if not the most successful campaign we've ever done for a show, audio was a core part of that.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. Not just a media company, iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Sports Social Podcast Network. Sports Social Podcast Network.
At Discount Tire, we know your time is valuable. Get 30% shorter average wait time when you buy and book online. Did you know Discount Tire now sells wiper blades? Check out our current deals at DiscountTire.com or stop in and talk to an associate today. Discount Tire.
Let's get you taken care of.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Fast Twitch, the new energy drink from Gatorade, is here. And it's powering fast starts for athletes in every arena, like NBA All-Star Zion Williamson, WNBA champ Kalia Copper, and MLB superstar Francisco Lindor. With 200 milligrams of caffeine, electrolytes, and zero sugar, Fast Twitch is the new go-to for on-the-go energy anytime you need to turn up the intensity. Available in 6 refreshing Gatorade-inspired flavors. Grab Fast Twitch in the energy drink aisle at a store near you.
Sports Social Podcast Network. Sports Social Podcast Network. Sports Social Podcast Network. Sports Social Podcast Network.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.